Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine, all of them published in January of 2025. Here's a sampling of the articles I know we'll have time for today. Trump can't escape the laws of political gravity. The chaos in higher ed is only getting started. Starbucks' most beloved offering is disappearing. And the border got quieter, so Trump had to act. Hopefully we'll have time for an additional article or two. I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this title, Trump Can't Escape the Laws of Political Gravity. Sooner or later, nature will catch up to the president. By Elliot Cohen. Sometimes politics resembles one of the weirder branches of modern physics, or a fantasy version of biology. Time may seem to run backwards. Solid things turn out to be insubstantial. Black holes swallow up the light. The dead may walk the earth. Ghouls crawl out of cleft rocks. Velociraptors not only reappear, but learn to speak, and alarmingly open doors. This is how American politics feels at the moment. By and large, however, Newtonian physics and traditional biology still apply. And that is worth remembering as we watch the Trump administration's circus of transgression, vindictiveness, and sometimes mere folly. Like most administrations, including those of considerably more sedate chief executives, that of the 47th president has decided to way overinterpret its mandate. The brute facts remain. Donald Trump received a plurality of votes, albeit a decisive majority in the Electoral College. The Republican Party is holding on to the House of Representatives by a hair and has a slim majority in the Senate. The administration may hate civil servants and seek to undermine their job security, but it will discover that it needs them to keep airplanes flying safely, the financial system functioning, drugs safe for use, and food fit for consumption. Gravity still works, if somewhat unreliably. Politicians who overinterpret narrow wins in a divided country get pulled back to earth, usually by the midterms. But not just that, the federal system of government gives a lot of power to the states. And although Congress has become anemic and irresponsible, most state governments have not. And so the governor of Florida has declined to appoint the president's daughter-in-law to a vacant Senate seat. And the governor of Ohio has passed on one of the president's more socially awkward tech billionaires for another. These are small but interesting indications of gravity reasserting itself. Lawyers by the thousands, in and out of state governments, create their own gravitational field. The poorly paid lawyers of the Justice Department can sue only so much, and the Supreme Court will turn out to be, as it did during the previous Trump administration, less reliably Trumpist than the president would wish. The most pro-Trump justices are Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, two of the conservatives he did not appoint. Even the appalling sweeping pardons of the January 6th rioters and insurrectionists have their limits. If any of those people attempt violence in Maryland or Virginia or anywhere else outside of D.C., they will discover that assault and other crimes there are tried in state, not federal courts. And the presidential pardon power does not reach state prisons, which means that some ghouls will be back to their cleft rocks if they go out looking for revenge. Newtonian physics also has it that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Precisely so. Pardon every criminal who clubbed a police officer, and police unions will be unamused. Impose high tariffs, and working-class voters will encounter higher prices, and possibly unemployment. Blow up the national debt to cut taxes, and sooner or later, the markets will react. Give way to vaccine skepticism, and epidemics will break out. Turn the intelligence community and military upside down by purging women and other undesirables, and you will produce not only big, embarrassing, consequential failures, but also pushback from those large populations, their families, and those politicians who still care about national defense. And then there is retribution. Political physics runs along the lines of the lyrics composed by Johnny Cash. That old wheel is going to roll around once more. When it does, it will even up the score. Or, as Shakespeare has Shylock put it rather more pointedly, the villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction. The reckless, violence-feeding mass pardons of the January 6th insurrectionists were evidence of Trumpian lawlessness. The orders to end the security clearances of scores of former senior intelligence officials who criticized Trump, and the stunning decision to remove security protection from John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and Brian Hook, three former senior officials of the first Trump administration, were pure personal meanness. Suspending clearances was intended as a humiliation and a blow at pocketbooks. Many of those targeted serve on corporate boards where clearances are a prerequisite, and cutting security protection against Iranian death threats was even worse. But Trump's appointees, who will carry out this and other acts of payback, should consider that before very long they too will be out of government. They too will want to keep their clearances, and they too may incur the wrath of state and non-state enemies who want to kill them. They will wish to consider just how exposed they will inevitably be once their triumph, like all others, passes into memory. If decency and respect for norms do not motivate them in the right direction, fear may have to serve in place. Biology also will have its say. Inebriation, with power and success in this case, invariably leads to hangovers, no matter what family remedies or magical cures one imbibes. That usually hits at the midterms, as the Obama and George W. Bush administrations found out the hard way. More to the point, certain biological realities, including age and its accompanying physical and mental decline, will operate during Trump's 80s. The flunkies and toadies who surround the president will seek to deny this elemental reality. The Biden team was egregious in this regard, but sooner or later it will take hold too. Primatology in this case offers a useful guide. In most troops of baboons, an alpha male dominates all the others, who exhibit submissive behavior if they know what's good for them. The dominance may be so pronounced that all the alpha male has to do is bare his fangs and snarl to get the behavior he wants. But baboons age, and although he may not notice, the alpha male's muscles will atrophy, his fangs will fall out. He may continue to snarl, but the younger male baboons will notice and begin to sense the possibility of a succession crisis. And then they pounce. So too here. Donald Trump is already a lame duck. He is, by any measure, old, which is one of the many reasons that comparisons with Hitler or younger contemporary European authoritarians, such as Viktor Orban, are misplaced. He will be an even lamer duck in 2 years, at which point the troop of Republican politicians will begin to struggle for the succession. Former friends, Donald Trump Jr. and J.D. Vance, for example, may fall out, and the coalition of differing subclans may fight more openly. Republican unity in several years is highly unlikely. It's a bad time in American politics, to be sure, but we need to remember that natural laws still apply, and things could get better even just if one piece of fantasy biology were to hold true. A large class of political invertebrates were to grow spines. That completes the article. The author, Elliot A. Cohen, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. He is a professor emeritus at Johns Hopkins University, the author of The Hollow Crown, Shakespeare on How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall, and co-host of the Shield of the Republic podcast. The name of his article was Trump Can't Escape the Laws of Political Gravity. This next article is titled The Chaos in Higher Ed is Only Getting Started. Grant reviews have been suspended at the NIH. This could be an omen. By Ian Bogost. I'd summarize it as fuck. That's what one senior university administrator told me when I asked about the chaos that erupted at the National Institutes of Health this week. Academics are in a panic mode in the face of sudden new restrictions from the Trump administration. The Department of Health and Human Services has told employees of several health agencies, including the NIH, to stop communicating with the public. Even more disruptive for universities, the committee meetings for reviewing NIH grant proposals have also been abruptly put on hold until at least February 1st. This will halt science and devastate research budgets in universities, Jane Liebschultz, a medical doctor and professor at the University of Pittsburgh, posted on Blue Sky in reference to the grant review shutdown. The UCLA professor, Lindsay Wiley, echoed the sentiment, adding on Blue Sky that the pause, which affects the distribution of a multi-billion-dollar pool of public research money, will have long-term effects on medicine and short-term effects on state, higher education, and hospital budgets. This affects all of us, not just researchers. Even if the mayhem ends early next month, it would still represent a large and lasting threat to universities in years to come. The NIH funds a major portion of the research that gets done on campus, and money from its grants also helps pay for universities' general operations. The fact that this support has been switched off so haphazardly, for reasons that remain unclear, and despite the scope of troubles it creates, suggests that higher ed will be profoundly vulnerable during the second Trump era. It's hard to overstate the role of HHS and the NIH in particular, in funding universities. In 2023, the department contributed $33 billion in research grants to American institutions of higher education, representing more than half of all federal spending on academic R&D. Indeed, HHS alone accounts for nearly one-third of all funding for university research, most of which is distributed by the NIH. This situation makes the NIH a golden goose for universities, and also a canary in a coal mine. Researchers know just how much research capital comes from the agency, and they worry about the calamity that might ensue if those funds were to be tied up more than momentarily. NIH money funds everything from basic science research, figuring out what a particular gene does, for example, to the work that makes that knowledge useful, inventing a new gene editing treatment, say. And its resources are put to use well beyond the field of medicine, which grants for work in biology, chemistry, physics, engineering, social sciences, and social work, among other fields. Take that all away, all at once, and a mess of different kinds of researchers are left uncertain as to whether and how long their labs, personnel, and experiments can be sustained. Not only is the NIH the most generous provider of government funding for research, but it also gives out money in a way that has secondary benefits for grantees and their institutions. For one thing, it generally doles out funds in larger chunks than other agencies. That's good for individual recipients. Writing grant proposals is a lot of work, so the fewer grants you have to chase, the more time you can spend doing actual science. Some NIH programs allow researchers to ask for standardized modular allocations, say $250,000 a year, instead of itemizing every element of a budget request. That saves time for science. NIH grants have their own appeal for university administrators, too, in the form of payments for what are called indirect costs. Most federal grants pay fees to cover overhead for whatever research has been funded. That money helps to pay for all of the campus infrastructure that goes into doing the research. This includes the buildings and labs in which the work gets done, the maintenance and management of those facilities, specialized equipment, the badge scanners, payroll services, and other costs associated with the postdoctoral researchers or research scientists who staff the labs, and other operational expenses. Exactly how much federal grant money gets added to a grant for indirect costs is subject to negotiation. Universities work with federal agencies to determine the percentage, which may change from year to year. Some funding sources, such as the Department of Agriculture, tend to pay lower rates, with perhaps a 30% premium going to indirect costs. But the NIH goes very high in general. Its rates will at times exceed 60%. Under such an arrangement, for every $1 million the agency gives to a scientist, that scientist's university gets $600,000. These overhead funds, of which the NIH is such an important source, are mysterious and complicated. Many universities rely on them to balance their budget. The problem is, schools almost always have to spend more money to support research than they take in from grants. They do the work anyway, both because research is part of their mission and because it helps them compete for better students, faculty, and rankings. But with grant-funded research already operating at a loss, any long-term interruption of schools' indirect cost revenue could create a real financial crisis on campus. Holden Thorpe, the editor-in-chief of Science and a former university chancellor and provo, told me that many schools could weather these disruptions without issue. A university with a big hospital, for example, might use clinical revenue to offset uncompensated research costs. But some schools could be destabilized by even a small-scale interference with the flow of agency grants, and most research institutions would be thrown into at least some disarray. An extended pause on grant funding isn't happening, or at least not yet. And Thorpe said that panic isn't a useful response to whatever is happening at the NIH. It's totally understandable for researchers, students, and administrators to be unnerved, he said. But there are many possible explanations, and it's best to keep calm and carry on. My own university, Washington University in St. Louis, made the same suggestion in a statement sent to faculty from the Vice Chancellor for Research. It reads, in part, "While these disruptions are frustrating, they are occurring government-wide and are not focusing on university research activities or targeting specific scientific disciplines." But the NIH freakout may have less to do with the present disruption, however long it lasts, than with what it signifies. If the viability of university research and of universities themselves can be so upended by a disarrangement of a single unit of the Department of Health and Human Services, then what might be coming next? Donald Trump's nominee to run the NIH, Jay Bhattacharya, has floated the idea of linking grants to measures of free speech on campus, according to the Wall Street Journal. And Trump's executive orders have already made clear that any federal grantee will have to answer for its own DEI initiatives. The Trump administration has many bones to pick with higher education, and it seems willing to abide and even encourage whatever chaos those squabbles may produce. The present situation might be a fluke, or it might be a test. That completes the article. The author, Ian Bogost, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. His title was "The Chaos in Higher Ed is Only Getting Started." I'll take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is The Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of The Atlantic Magazine. All the articles today have been published in January of 2025. And on a somewhat lighter note, Starbucks' most beloved offering is disappearing. It's the end of free bathrooms and of a particular fantasy. Written by Ellen Cushing. In Blaine, Washington, there is a very special Starbucks. Like every Starbucks, this one has tables and chairs and coffee and pastries and a pacifying sort of vibe. Also, like most Starbucks, it has a bathroom, open to anyone who walks in. The bathroom is important because this Starbucks is located about 3/4 of a mile past Peace Arch, the busiest border crossing west of Detroit, and a wretched, wretched place where you can sometimes get stuck in a car for several hours without warning. The Blaine Starbucks looks out onto the magnificent Semiahmoo Bay and is, I guess for that reason, designed like a working lighthouse. At night you can see it from all over the city center. The metaphor is almost too beautiful. Here is Starbucks, and here is its warm light, guiding you to shore. Just about as soon as your huddled masses enter America, Starbucks is ready to take care of you. Do you need to pee? Of course you do. Too bad, last week, Starbucks, which has had a new CEO since September, announced an updated code of conduct, which mandates that the coffee shop's spaces, including cafes, patios, and restrooms, will soon be for paying customers only. There is a need, Sarah Trilling, the president of Starbucks North America, wrote in a letter to store managers, to reset expectations for how our spaces should be used and who uses them. Starbucks, the chain that took over the world by being everywhere and for everyone, is now a little less for everyone. The change appears to be pitched at returning Starbucks to its former glory, when Starbucks was, in theory at least, not just a store, but also a gathering space. If you look at the landscape of retail and restaurants in America, there is such a fracturing of places where people meet. The company's famed former CEO, Howard Schultz, told an industry publication in 1995, "There's nowhere for people to go, so we created a place where people can feel comfortable. Starbucks was to feel like a third place, an idea borrowed from the sociologist Ray Oldenburg. Not home, not work, but somewhere else, a place where community is formed and civility is fostered. A place like church, where people gather on equal footing and find meaning." For a while, it actually worked, in both the high-minded sense and the business sense. Starbucks was America's, and then the world's, second living room, a place where people were happy to spend their money every day. The chairs were comfortable enough, and all those laptop clackers and book readers were like extras in the movie everyone thinks they are starring in. People may not have been foraging deep connections with their fellow man at Starbucks, but they were, demonstrably, living their lives there. Americans have given birth at Starbucks, proposed at Starbucks, gotten married at Starbucks, died at Starbucks. In 1987, there were 17 Starbucks stores. In 2007, there were more than 15,000 in 43 countries. But now the internet has become our third space, and Starbucks has become, by and large, a well-outfitted to-go counter. 7 out of 10 Starbucks orders are completed via mobile app or drive-thru. Walk into any store, and you will see harried baristas frantically making drinks for people whose goal is certainly not to build community, but rather to sprint in and sort through the forest of Frappuccinos to find theirs, if it's ready. Last year, on a podcast, Schultz, who is no longer Starbucks' CEO, but is still a major shareholder, described the scene as a mosh pit, and not in a positive way. During the second quarter of 2024, transactions dropped 7%, the chain's worst quarter that didn't involve a pandemic or a Great Recession. 3 months later, Brian Niccol took over as CEO. His second day on the job, he released a statement titled, "Back to Starbucks." It describes the cafe as a gathering space, a community center, where conversations are sparked, friendships form, and everyone is greeted by a welcoming barista. Many customers still experience this magic every day, but in some places, especially in the U.S., we aren't always delivering, Niccol wrote. It can feel transactional. Menus can feel overwhelming. Product is inconsistent. The wait too long, or the handoff too hectic. These moments are opportunities for us to do better. Though the new code of conduct does not include the word loitering, the implication that Starbucks wants to ban it is there. The company wants to be a place for people to hang out, but not just any people. This is, of course, any company's prerogative. Still, Starbucks making this decision in the name of becoming a better community center is both patently silly and a little delusional. Community centers don't typically require you to buy a cake pop to enter. And to the degree that Starbucks brings people together, it is because they are all using the same services. Wi-Fi, outlets, air conditioning, water, bathrooms, at the same time. It's not a church, it's a rest stop. But the corporate grandiosity also speaks to something somewhat profound and sad about what Starbucks does offer and what no other large-scale entity does. Public restrooms, once an ordinary feature of urban American life, are disappearing. So are public water fountains. 1 in 15 Americans does not have access to high-speed internet and widespread free municipal Wi-Fi, a dream of the techno-utopian 2000s, has yet to come to pass. Libraries across the country are cutting their hours. All the people who were left without a place to work after the pandemic closed their offices do not necessarily have a public replacement. Urban spaces are being explicitly designed to be annoying or impossible to sit in. Starbucks is, or was, a respite from all that. But, of course, making a global corporation a municipal utility is not exactly a long-term solution. Starbucks is a business. The company formalized its open-door bathroom policy several years ago, after two black men were arrested for trying to use the facilities while having a meeting, the video of which went viral and caused a public relations crisis. Now Starbucks is reversing it, also presumably for reasons having to do with being a business, one that is accountable to its shareholders every quarter. The company's stock prices has indeed risen by about 6% since the bathroom change was announced. Starbucks doesn't sell community, but community isn't something you can buy. It sells coffee, because coffee is something you can. That's the end of the article. The title was Starbucks' Most Beloved Offering is Disappearing, by Atlantic staff writer Ellen Cushing. The next title is The Border Got Quieter, So Trump Had to Act. The president would rather exploit a free-for-all than manage migrant flows effectively, by Juliet K.M. For President Donald Trump, inheriting a relatively quiet and orderly southern border with Mexico is a political inconvenience. During his campaign, he painted an apocalyptic picture of migrants swarming the frontier, and he returned to the White House organized and ready for border wars, even as U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported fewer and fewer illegal crossings. Shortly after taking the presidential oath Monday, Trump declared a national security emergency for the border, ordered the military to make plans to secure it, and signed a constitutionally questionable executive order restricting birthright citizenship. Much more telling and immediately consequential, though, was the new administration's decision to shut down the border agency's app, CBP-1, which had allowed asylum seekers who had not yet crossed into U.S. territory to make appointments at legal ports of entry. Migrants who were waiting in Mexico and expecting to meet with CBP screening officers this week, learned that existing appointments have been canceled. Far from preventing chaos, though, killing CBP-1 could produce more. Then again, Trump's political interest lies in exploiting the border, not effectively managing it. This week, social media platforms were flooded with pictures of crying asylum seekers who had appointments scheduled after Trump's oath and realized they were out of luck. Those pictures may gratify MAGA diehards and make some in the Trump coalition think cry harder. But migrants don't simply disappear by wishing them away. The conditions that brought them to the U.S. border didn't miraculously get less pressing with Trump's presidency. And people who cannot seek asylum legally in the United States may instead pursue unlawful ways to enter the country. The president and his supporters would have the public believe that CBP-1 was an online concierge service for illegals, as Senator Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, recently described it. They made an application to facilitate illegal immigration, Vice President J.D. Vance declared last week. In fact, CBP-1 embodied the kind of imperfect but pragmatic compromise that's essential in immigration policy. The app was introduced under the Trump administration in 2020 to manage cargo truck crossings at the border. The Biden administration expanded CBP-1 in 2023, creating a process by which a limited number of migrants could lawfully apply for asylum, which, under federal law, people fleeing persecution in their home countries are allowed to do, while also imposing considerable restrictions on that opportunity. Previously, people entering the country could assert their intention to seek asylum after presenting themselves to a U.S. official anywhere along the border. They would then typically be paroled into the country while awaiting a hearing on their application, and they could apply for a special permit to work lawfully. Eventually, President Joe Biden concluded, albeit amid intense political pressure, that the asylum system was being overused and that an influx of applicants was swamping the government's ability to administer it. After CBP-1 was established, asylum seekers needed to present themselves at a port of entry, if they could get there, at a specified time, if they could get one of the 1,450 appointments available each day. The administration generally declined to hear asylum claims made by any other means, even as the system created a clear process for seeking asylum, one that, according to the Associated Press, facilitated the entry of nearly a million migrants. It was intentionally designed to curb asylum access and has been much maligned by progressives and immigration advocates for that reason. Indeed, immigrant rights advocates sued the Biden administration because they viewed the app process as exclusionary to the point of violating federal law. The recent decline in illegal crossings, the 36,600 illegal crossings in November, represented the lowest number in more than 4 years, is happening partly because Mexico and other countries throughout Latin America are clamping down on migration via their territory. But it's also because CBP-1 had helped to end a free-for-all and establish a well-organized line. Despite his anti-immigrant rhetoric, Trump was not obviously more effective than other recent presidents in controlling migration flows. perhaps unsurprisingly, the lowest number of illegal crossings during his first administration occurred at the height of the coronavirus pandemic. In place of CBP-1, the new administration has asserted that it will reinstate Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, under which many asylum applicants would have to stay south of the border while their cases are being adjudicated. During Trump's first term, about 70,000 asylum seekers waited in Mexico for an immigration hearing, and unlawful border crossings were higher than during the Obama administration. The number of illegal crossings in the final months of Trump's first administration were higher than in the final months of Biden's. Trump's recent moves have unsettled the legal process. This week, immigration rights groups that have sued the government over CBP-1 sought an emergency hearing to determine the new administration's impact on asylum efforts. They had contacted government lawyers to ask about the effect of Trump's announcements, but those lawyers, according to the plaintiffs' legal filings, said they could not provide their position yet. The value to Trump of ending CBP-1 appears to be mostly political. The current situation at the border neither accords with his basic expectations nor justifies the kind of far-reaching emergency measures that the new president and his allies are intent on pursuing. The asylum process has been thrown back into confusion, and the abolition of legal pathways to asylum increases the incentives for illegal crossings. Ending CBP-1 conveniently helps lay the groundwork for more aggressive policies. The voters who sent Trump back to the White House may have been appalled by past chaos, but Trump's anti-immigration offensive order is a bigger problem. That completes the article. Juliet K.M. is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and the author of The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. This next title is Europe's Elon Musk Problem. He and other tech oligarchs are making it impossible to conduct free and fair elections anywhere, by Anne Applebaum. During an American election, a rich man can hand out $1 million checks to prospective voters. Companies and people can use secretly funded dark money, nonprofits, to donate unlimited money anonymously to super PACs, which can then spend it on advertising campaigns. Podcasters, partisans, or anyone, really, can tell outrageous, incendiary lies about a candidate. They can boast those falsehoods through targeted online advertising. No special courts or election rules can stop the disinformation from spreading before voters see it. The court of public opinion, which over the past decade has seen and heard everything, no longer cares. U.S. elections are now a political Las Vegas. Anything goes. But that's not the way elections are run in other countries. In Britain, political parties are, at least during the run-up to an election, limited to spending no more than £54,010 per candidate. In Germany, as in many other European countries, the state funds political parties proportionate to their number of elected parliamentarians, so that politicians do not have to depend on and become corrupted by wealthy donors. In Poland, courts fast-track election-related libel cases in the weeks before a vote in order to discourage people from lying. Nor is this unique to Europe. Many democracies have state or public media that are obligated, at least in principle, to give equal time to all sides. Many require political donations to be transparent, with the names of donors listed in an online registry. Many have limits on political advertising. Some countries also have rules about hate speech and indict people who break them. Countries apply these laws to create conditions for fair debate, to build trust in the system, and to inspire confidence in the winning candidates. Some democracies believe that transparency matters, that voters should know who is funding their candidates, as well as who is paying for political messages on social media or anywhere else. In some places, these rules have a loftier goal: to prevent the rise of anti-democratic extremism of the kind that has engulfed democracies, and especially European democracies, in the past. But for how much longer can democracies pursue these goals? We live in a world in which algorithms, controlled by American and Chinese oligarchs, choose the messages and images seen by millions of people, in which money can move through secret bank accounts with the help of crypto schemes, and in which this dark money can then boost anonymous social media accounts with the aim of shaping public opinion. In such a world, how can any election rules be enforced? If you are Albania, or even the United Kingdom, do you still get to set the parameters of your public debate? Or are you now forced to be Las Vegas too? Although it's easy to get distracted by the schoolyard nicknames and irresponsible pedophilia accusations that Elon Musk flings around, these are the real questions posed by his open, aggressive use of X to spread false information and promote extremist and anti-European politicians in the UK, Germany, and elsewhere. The integrity of elections and the possibility of debate untainted by misinformation injected from abroad is equally challenged by TikTok, the Chinese platform, and by Mark Zuckerberg's Meta, whose subsidies include Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Threads. TikTok says the company does not accept any paid political advertising. Meta, which announced in January that it is abandoning fact-checking on its site in the U.S., also says it will continue to comply with European laws. But even before Zuckerberg's radical policy change, these promises were empty. Meta's vaunted content curation and moderation have never been transparent. Nobody knew and nobody knows what exactly Facebook's algorithm was promoting and why. Even an occasional user of these platforms encounters spammers, scammers, and opaque accounts running foreign influence operations. No guide to the algorithm and no real choices about it are available on Meta products, X or TikTok. In truth, no one knows if any platforms really comply with political funding rules either, because nobody outside the companies can fully monitor what happens online during an intense election campaign. And after the voting has ended, it's too late. According to declassified Romanian intelligence documents, someone allegedly spent more than $1 million on TikTok content in the 18 months before an election in support of a Romanian presidential candidate who declared that he himself had spent nothing at all. In a belated attempt to address this and other alleged discrepancies, a Romanian court canceled the first round of that election, a decision that itself damaged Romanian democracy. Not all of this is new. Surreptitious political party funding was a feature of the Cold War, and the Russian government has continued this practice, sometimes by offering deals to foreign business people close to pro-Russian politicians. Press moguls with international political ambitions are hardly a novelty. Rupert Murdoch, an Australian who has U.S. citizenship, has long played an outsized role in U.K. politics through his media companies. John Major, the former British Prime Minister and Conservative Party leader, has said that in 1997, Murdoch threatened to pull his newspaper's support unless the Prime Minister pursued a more anti-European policy. Major refused. Murdoch has said, "I have never asked a Prime Minister for anything." But one of his conservative-leaning tabloids, The Sun, did endorse the Labour Party in the next election. Major lost. That incident now seems almost quaint. Even at the height of its influence, the print edition of The Sun sold 4 million copies a day. More to the point, it operated, and still does, within the constraints of UK rules and regulations, as do all broadcast and print media. Murdoch's newspapers take British libel and hate speech laws into consideration when they run stories. His business strategy is necessarily shaped by rules limiting what a single company can own. After his journalists were accused of hacking phones and bribing police in the early 2000s, Murdoch himself had to testify before an investigative commission, and he closed down one of his tabloids for good. Social media not only has far greater reach. Musk's personal X account has more than 212 million followers, giving him enormous power to set the news agenda around the world. It also exists outside the legal system. Under the American law known as Section 230, passed nearly three decades ago, internet platforms are not treated as publishers in the U.S. In practice, neither Facebook nor X has the same legal responsibility for what appears on their platforms as do, say, The Wall Street Journal and CNN. And this, too, has consequences. Americans have created the information climate that other countries must accept, and this allows deceptive election practices to thrive. If countries don't have their own laws, and until recently most did not, Section 230 effectively requires them to treat social media companies as if they exist outside their legal systems too. Brazil broke this pattern last year when a judge demanded that Musk comply with Brazilian laws against spreading misinformation and political extremism, and forced X offline until he did. Several European countries, including the UK, Germany, and France, have also passed laws designed to bring the platforms into compliance with their own legal systems, mandating fines for companies that violate hate speech laws or host other illegal content. But these laws are controversial and hard to enforce. Besides, illegal speech is not necessarily the central problem. No laws prevented Musk from interviewing Alice Weidel, a leader of the far-right Alternative for Germany party, on X, thereby providing her with a huge platform available to no other political candidate in the month before a national election. The interview, which included several glaringly false statements, among others that Weidel was the leading candidate, was viewed 45 million times in 24 hours, a number far beyond the reach of any German public or private media. Only one institution on the planet is large enough and powerful enough to write and enforce laws that could make the tech companies change their policies. Partly for that reason, the European Union may soon become one of the Trump administration's most prominent targets. In theory, the EU's Digital Services Act, which took full effect last year, can be used to regulate, fine, and in extreme circumstances, ban internet companies whose practices clash with European laws. Yet a primary intent of the act is not punitive, but rather to open up the platforms, to allow vetted researchers access to platform data, and to give citizens more transparency about what they hear and see. Freedom of speech also means the right to receive information, and at the moment social media companies operate behind a curtain. We don't know if they are promoting or suppressing certain points of view, curbing or encouraging orchestrated political campaigns, discouraging or provoking violent riots. Above all, we don't know who is paying for misinformation to be spread online. And it looks like we have run out of time today. The name of this article was Europe's Elon Musk Problem by Ann Applebaum. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all published in January of 2025. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, the one you're looking for is there. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.